I'd like to read part of a verse from what is probably the most memorized psalm in the Bible. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. That's really what we're going to be talking about today. And if you think about it, the book of Revelation was written during a period in which persecution was beginning, and it was only going to get worse for a good 150 years more or 200 years more. It was just going to get worse. This book was written to encourage Christians during what was going to be a couple of centuries of very difficult times. This psalmist, I think, here expresses very well this notion that life is not always easy and it's not always safe. But when we've found our security in God, somehow those things no longer matter to us. We're not afraid of what the government might do to us. We're not afraid of what the boogeyman might do. We're not afraid of what the bad people out there will do. Not because we think God is going to exempt us from anything bad. We know those things may come. But we know that God has us secure. And that's the confidence that we have in Christ. So that's really what we're going to be talking about in today's passage. Let me ask you to stand out of reverence to the Word of God and read together with me. We're going to be looking at Revelation 13, the first 10 verses. So let's read aloud together. And I saw a beast rising up out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, and on its horns 10 diadems, and on its heads blasphemous names. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, and its feet as those of a bear, and its mouth as a lion's mouth. And the dragon gave it his power and his throne and great authority. And one of its heads seemed to have been killed dead, but its deadly wound was healed. And the whole earth marveled after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon because he gave authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who is able to wage war against it?" And it was given a mouth that spoke great things and blasphemies, and it was given authority to act for 42 months. And it opened its mouth to blaspheme against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, those who have pitched their tent in heaven. And it was given authority to wage war against the saints and to conquer them. And it was given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all those dwelling on earth whose name has not been inscribed in the scroll of life of the Lamb, the one slain from the foundation of the cosmos, will worship him. If anyone has an ear, hear. If one is to go into captivity he goes. If one is to be killed by short sword he is killed. This constitutes the endurance and the faith of the saints. Thank you so much. You may be seated. We're continuing here in our series of sermons from the book of Revelation. I've titled today's message, "I Will Fear No Evil." We pick up the scene from what we were looking at last week. And last week we saw this scene of a woman, which I believe represents the nation of Israel, the people that God used to bring the Messiah into the world, and how she is in labor pains to give birth to this one who is to shepherd the nations with an iron staff, and how this other figure arises, the dragon, which is clearly identified in Revelation as Satan. And his intent is to destroy this child as soon as he's born, but he does not succeed. This child is not only born, but accomplishes what he came to accomplish and is snatched up to the Father and his throne. We have a description there of the ascension and glorification of Christ after his resurrection. And we return to the scene of the woman, which I believe represents not just Israel in the generic sense, but the Israel of the faith, those of the people of Israel who had put their faith in God's Messiah and have become the beginnings of the church. He turns his focus on the woman to destroy her and is unsuccessful. The woman is shielded and protected. And then the dragon focuses his attention on the woman's offspring, which I think is a way of referring to the church as it has spread beyond the original Jewish believers to the Gentiles, to the nations. And all of a sudden, Israel has children in every corner of the world. And the dragon has been utterly defeated, expelled from heaven, cast out, and barred from ever coming before God to bring accusations against anyone. That's what Christ has accomplished in his victory at the cross. And Satan is a defeated foe, but he is on earth now, and he is raging and knows his time is short. His defeat has already been accomplished. And all he has left is whatever remaining time God allows him to do as much damage as he can. And that's kind of how we closed last week, with his utter failure to destroy the Messiah, to destroy the people that brought the Messiah, to even destroy those who have spread from the woman to all the other children of Israel that now are around the globe. And in utter frustration, we closed last week with a very ominous scene of the dragon standing on the seashore, looking out over the sea. And this is an ominous picture for a Jewish person, at least. The Jews were not seafarers. They never took to the ocean, to the seas. They were not like the Phoenicians further up north. They were the masters of the Mediterranean Sea. But their shores were not adequate. They were kind of sandy. They didn't have good harbors, and they just never took to the sea. So the sea was to the Jew a very frightening and unknowable thing. It was the place of watery death. It was the place of unknown things and dangerous things. In the prophecies, the sea is often referred to in that way. So we have this ominous picture of the dragon overlooking the sea, and now we figure out what's he doing, what's he up to. And he's basically seen summoning a beast from the sea. So this is where we continue the vision now, as John sees the dragon, Satan, raising this beast out of the sea. And the beast is described as having 10 horns. Horns, if we look through the Bible, are associated with strength, with the power to do what you're trying to accomplish, to implement what you're doing. But basically, and oftentimes it's used in military context to denote strength. The fact that something has the power to accomplish what it is meant to do. That's why, for example, the altar had four horns on each of its corners to signify the efficacy of the altar to accomplish the atonement that it was meant to accomplish. 10 horns, and the number 10 represents, I think, the idea of something complete. Perhaps because a normal person, if he has not lost a digit throughout his lifetime, if he is complete in terms of digits, will have 10 fingers. So the idea of complete. So this beast is described then as having complete power. And then he has 7 heads, and in case we misunderstand in what sense the heads are being referred to here, the heads are sporting diadems, which is the word of choice for the kind of crown the Caesar would wear, the kind of crown ruling authorities would wear. That was the aesthetic of the day. They would wear royal diadems, which is, by the way, not the same word used to describe the crown the woman wears, which is a stephanos, which is like a laurel wreath, and that denotes victory. A diadem denotes ruling authority. So heads, as in being the head of something, the head of state, the idea of ruling power and governance and authority. He has 7 heads. In other words, he has perfect authority and complete power. That's the image we're getting from the use of the numbers and the imagery here. The beast that I saw, you might think, well, he has all these horns. Maybe we're thinking of some kind of an ox or some kind of an herbivore that just has these things for defensive purposes. But in case we misunderstand, this beast is described as a predator. This is not some herbivore. He is described as a beast that is lithe and nimble and cunning like a leopard, but also has the raw power of a bear and the regal bearing of a lion. I think we have here a description of what was the most glorious empire the earth had seen until its day, the Roman Empire. This is the beast that Satan is drawing up from the sea. And if you think of the recipients of this in Asia Minor, Rome was across the Aegean Sea from them, and it would have that's where this kingdom would have come to them from. And the dragon gives him power and authority and his throne. So the dragon is sharing his own authority and power with him. And you might think, well, what throne or authority does Satan have? And I want to remind you that in the New Testament, he is described as having enormous power on earth. Let me give you just a couple of quick examples. Paul describes him as the ruler of the power of the air in Ephesians 2. Verse 2, and Jesus himself in John 12 describes him as the ruler of this world. So the dragon takes all of this authority and influence and power that he has and bestows it all on this empire, represented by the beast. Give me just a second here. I must not be living right. Okay, I'm back there. What else do we see about this beast? And this is perhaps the thing that most people who kind of study the history of the time and try to figure out what it might have been referring to in the first century when it was written, this is probably the detail that I think makes it clearest that we're talking about the Roman Empire. One of its heads seemed to have been killed dead, but its deadly wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled after the beast. So this idea that one of its heads, one of the representations of its ruling authority, and I would suggest that we're talking here about one of its kings, one of its Caesars, was killed and came back. Now, there's something fishy about this. When we talk about the two witnesses, they are killed and they are raised back to life. And there's no, it seemed like when we're describing that. But when we're talking about this, there's something fishy about the whole thing. It's like, and it seemed like he'd been killed. And there's something not quite real or right about it. But one of the oddities of the first century is that especially in Asia Minor was circulating this rumor, this expectation, this idea that Nero, the emperor, who had died in the year 68, AD 68, that he was going to come back. And in the intervening years leading up to Domitian, which is when I think this is being written, there were numerous people that showed up that looked like Nero. And people were thinking, oh, Nero's back. Or people showed up claiming to be Nero. And several people in the intervening years have already been killed because the Caesars saw them as threats of this idea of Nero come back to life. In fact, there were some people who even thought that Domitian was kind of a reincarnation of Nero. But there was this very popular expectation that there was this emperor, Roman emperor, who was going to come back. And some would even say he had come back in Domitian. So this idea of the beast having this mortal wound and recovering from it, I think is a reference to this Nero come back to life rumor that was circulating at the time. Now, it's interesting that when we have the two witnesses, their resurrection causes the earth to respond with horror. This kind of fake resurrection we're talking about here really wows the world, and everybody is so impressed at this whole thing, and their reaction is to worship the dragon because he's given so much authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, and they're so convinced that there is nobody who can stand against this all-powerful beast. And I think about it. I think in the day, if you were living in the middle of these years of the Roman Empire and all of its glory and all that they had accomplished, the system of roads and their army and their efficiency in terms of organizing themselves as an empire, it was just something nobody had accomplished before. Their engineering feats, not just engineering in the city planning type thing, but engineering also in terms of social development, their legal system, and all the kinds of things that they were putting together. They were so impressed. This was the mightiest thing that had ever happened on earth. And if you doubt that, let me ask you, how many TV shows and movies today are still being produced that are fascinated with the period of the Roman Empire? We still look back on that as one of the grandest accomplishments of humankind, this mighty empire. So I think that's what we have described here in the beast. The Roman Empire, this tremendous force that seems to have absorbed the world and is going to keep control of it. There's nobody that can take that control away from him. And the world loves it. The world loves a winner. The world loves being part of the one who's on top of everything. They worship this accomplishment of man. Did I skip something? Let me see. The note about the heads bearing blasphemous names, I think also accords well with the Roman Empire, because as the Caesars became more and more powerful, they really bought into this idea of the divinity of the Caesar. And the whole Caesar cult was woven into the pagan religion of the day, so that all the Caesars were constantly commissioning statues of themselves, scattering them throughout the whole kingdom, and establishing people in these different places to run the worship of the emperor in all these places, which, if you pay attention to the Bible, is blasphemous. For any man to claim to be due the honor that the Creator alone deserves from humankind is a blasphemous claim. So the fact that these heads, these symbols of ruling authority, these kings, and I wouldn't say seven is a literal number of seven kings, but these kings are involved in blaspheming against God. I will point out that one of the worst perpetrators of this was Domitian himself, who insisted on being addressed as Supreme Lord and God. In fact, if he received a communication, a written communication, and was not addressed that way, he refused to open it. He insisted on being addressed as Supreme Lord and God. And these things that God alone can claim were things that the Romans claimed. The Caesars claimed. They called themselves Savior. They called themselves Lord. And they expected to be worshipped as God alone deserves to be worshipped. So why does Satan ally himself with the Roman Empire? Why does he raise up this great empire? What's he trying to accomplish with this empire? It was given a mouth that spoke great things and blasphemies, and people were only too happy to worship statues of the emperor and to acclaim him as a god. If you study the history of the Jewish people between the end of the Old Testament and the time when the New Testament was written, you'll realize that it's a constant struggle. As soon as the Romans come on the scene, it's a constant struggle to keep the Romans from putting a statue of the emperor in the temple in Jerusalem. And back and forth, there are many Jews who lose their lives because they riot against attempts to do just that. And this is an ongoing thing. So this beast, this empire, is given a mouth that speaks great things and blasphemies, and it is given authority to act for 42 months. If we do the math, 42 months is, guess how many years? 3.5, right. And I find this consistent usage of the number 3.5 in Revelation. It seems like every time we come to 3.5, God's people are not doing terribly well. It seems like every time we get to 3.5, God's people are facing some horrible thing, some really challenging thing. And here we come to that again, 3.5. So this beast is given authority to act for 3.5 years. And I pointed out, I really think 3.5 is significant. I think it's meant to be understood as halfway to 7. If 7 represents perfection, then I think 3.5 puts us in the hopeful middle. So the people of God are always undergoing something negative when we use this number, but they are hopefully enduring it because they know what's coming at the end of things. They know what is at the other side of the current period of suffering. And this suffering is very undefined. 3.5 is such an odd number. And we don't know exactly how long it's going to last literally and how long this suffering is going to go on. But we endure because we know where we're headed. So I think John is communicating to the believers in Asia Minor that God has granted to Satan the power to so use the Roman Empire that it's going to be really rough for some time to come. And it's going to be difficult. And he's not only allowed to blaspheme against God, and he blasphemes God's name. It's interesting to me that the early Christians sometimes referred to themselves as people of the name, referring to Jesus Christ. And his tabernacle, and in case we misunderstand what we're talking about, John explains what he means by God's tabernacle. Those who have tabernacled in heaven. Now that word could generally, the general usage means to dwell, but the etymology of it points to living in a tent. And there's a kind of a play on words, you know, God's tabernacle, God's tent, and those who have chosen to pitch their tent in heaven. So here's the picture. When we talk about God's house, we're talking about the people who have made God their home. And when that happens, in return, God makes them his home. We who have tabernacled, who have pitched our tent in heaven, are actually the ones that God is dwelling in right now here on earth. And this is who the beast is focusing his attention on. The beast is blaspheming not only God, but those in whom God dwells. You know, if you read the Romans who bother to mention Christians, their words about us are terribly dismissive and insulting. The term Christian was not meant as some kind of an honorific. It was demeaning. It was meant to demean Christians, much as Jesus was often called a Nazarene, not because that people were so impressed with Nazareth. It's that kind of thing. This empire is given the power to badmouth God and his people. But it's not just that. He's given authority to wage war against the saints, those who belong to God, and to win, to conquer them. He was given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation. So the picture we have here is, for some amount of time, God is allowing this, that the Roman Empire is going to be persecuting Christians. And guess what? There's really nowhere you're going to be able to run to hide from this, because he's been given authority everywhere. This empire spans the globe. You're not going to be able to run away from it. You're stuck in it. And he's been given authority to defeat the saints. We are going to be easy prey to this empire. That's basically the message that's being delivered to the Christians who are receiving this. That sounds like terribly bad news, doesn't it? There is some good news, but it might not sound like it. as we get further in this passage. But let's keep going. All those dwelling on earth whose name has not been inscribed in the scroll of life of the Lamb, the one slain from the foundation of the cosmos, will worship him. So everybody on earth is going to worship him except. So not quite everybody is going to worship this beast. Not quite everybody is going to worship at the altar of human achievement. Now you'll realize to this day that is where most people like to worship. They like to worship at the altar of what humankind has accomplished. Not everybody. There are some whose name has been inscribed in the scroll of life of the Lamb. Now those whose name has not been inscribed there are only too happy, because having rejected God, the only thing they have left to turn to is man. So they will worship man. But there are some whose name has been inscribed in the scroll of life of the Lamb. I don't think that there's a literal scroll somewhere with all these names written down, but it is a visual way of representing the idea that God knows exactly who belongs to him. He has got a perfect list of who is his. And this phrase, from the foundation of the cosmos or of the world, that could apply either to the one slain or those whose name has not been inscribed. Wait, I'm sorry. The way that phrase is written, you could apply that either to the Lamb or to the ones who are not worshiping the beast. In other words, your name was inscribed from the foundation of the world, or the Lamb was slain from the foundation of the world. I'm sorry, I'm probably confusing you more than helping. Those are the two options, and some translators will go one way and some will go the other. If you look at modern translations, they kind of go both ways. It's interesting, I was looking at the notes in the Net Bible. You remember we had Daniel Wallace here, who's about as top level an expert on Greek as you're going to find. He in the Net Notes, they go with not the way I translated it, but and the reason they give is that in chapter 17 there's a similar phrasing, but in that phrase it's very clear the Greek there is undeniably talking about those whose names have been inscribed from the foundation of the world. So in that passage, it's very clear that we're talking about people having their names written in the book of life or the scroll of life from before the foundation of the world. Now, but it's interesting, in his note there in the Net Bible, they say that really the construction in the Greek should say that it applies to the Lamb, but because it, in the other passage it does it the other way, they translate it as applying to the ones whose name has been inscribed. I think actually John's telling us both things, that the slaying of the Lamb is an event in God's chronology that predates the foundation of the world, just as God's knowledge, perfect knowledge of who belongs to him, predates the foundation of the world. I think he's telling us both things. So when I get to the other passage, I'll translate that one the other way. But what does this mean then? I think that means, and there are a few other passages in the New Testament that suggest this, that before God began creation, he knew what was going to come. He knew that it would involve the Lamb. And he said, okay, I'll do it anyway. And the decision for the Lamb to be slain was made before creation even started. Now, there are people whose names are written in God's book of life, people who belong to God. If you're one of those people, then we should not be impressed by human achievements. Not impressed to the point of giving our devotion and worship to them. Not impressed to the point of thinking somehow that this surpasses God himself. And really what we end up having in these grand human empires is basically the Tower of Babel all over again. It's our attempt to make something of ourselves and take the place of God. That's what the Roman Empire is doing. And the world is all too happy to join the chorus of its praises, except the ones who belong to the Lamb. Everyone else is worshiping this empire. So, where's the good news? Well, here's the good news. If anyone has an ear, hear. Does that sound familiar to you? Is there anybody else in the Bible that used that phrase often? Jesus loved to use this phrase. And he would often use this phrase when he was telling people things they didn't really care to hear. Right? And the phrase basically means, if you've got ears, use them. If you can hear, pay attention and hear. And normally this precedes an important communication that you might be reluctant to receive. You might not want to hear this. But here's the truth of the matter. If one is to go into captivity he goes. If the Romans take you and seize all your possessions and take you and your children and sell you into slavery, then that's what's going to happen. If one is to be killed by short sword, this is the standard weapon of the Roman centurions and legionnaires, by short sword he is killed. It's going to happen. Some of you are going to die. Some of you are going to be enslaved. Some of you are going to be treated miserably. If that's what's going to happen to you, that's what's going to happen. That doesn't sound like great news. But this constitutes the endurance and the faith of the saints. Our faith is not wishful thinking. Our faith is not a hope in the sense of, boy, I really hope this happens. Our faith, it's the way Hebrews defines faith. Faith is that thing that connects me from where I am right now with that certain thing that is awesome that is not yet here. Faith is what connects me to that. Why do Christians endure captivity and death and refuse to relent? Why do they refuse to shut up about Jesus, even when threatened with death? Here's the thing. People who have found the Lamb have realized they have discovered the thing that their soul needed. The one thing that we needed. And we've discovered that there is nothing else. There is no comfort. There is no amenity. There is no advantage. There is no commodity that we would rather have than Jesus. There is nothing that surpasses the worth of Jesus. That's what we've discovered. We've discovered the only true wealth that can be found in life. So we are being told in Revelation, sometimes clinging to Jesus is going to mean enduring horrendous things. This is what constitutes the endurance and the faith of the saints. It happens all the time, the world over. Christians are losing their life this very day because they have discovered they would rather have Jesus than anything else. What's the good news in all of this? Well, the good news is that the dragon and his pets have already lost. It doesn't matter what they do to us. It doesn't matter what they rally to bring against us. And here's the funny thing. We now live 2,000 years almost later than all of this. And you know who is still around? The church. You know who has crumbled into the dust? The mighty Roman Empire. It's gone. It's a joke. All we have left are ruins. I thought they were going to rule forever. I thought no one could ever rise up against them. Well, guess what? That was a lie. Its power was not unlimited. And it was granted tremendous power for 3.5 years. For a time in the middle that was really hard for Christians. But Christians, if you study your history, you'll realize there are a lot of Christians who endured horrendous torture during these centuries. And Christians who lost their lives. And they read Revelation and they understood, you know what? What I have in Christ is worth anything. Whatever. And Satan can wave his hands in my face and he can raise up any pets of his he wants, but I will not budge. I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. That constitutes the endurance and the faith of the saints. We're going to sing a song of invitation. I'd like to ask the musicians to come forward. If you're here today and you don't know Jesus, let me tell you, you don't know life. You were created by Him and for Him. And your soul will never know peace until you come and give everything you have to Him. If that's you this morning, during this time, we have people here at the front. I want you to come and share that and tell the people here at the front, I want to give my life to Jesus. Maybe you already know Jesus and you've been challenged today. In terms of what Jesus is asking of you. And I want you to know, Jesus is not promising you that if you follow Him, nothing bad will ever happen to you. He's telling you, if you follow Him, you participate in His victory over sin and death and will enjoy glory with Him forever. Maybe you need to come today and tell Jesus, I'm sorry that I have allowed the cost of my trust in you to seem too high. And I want to repent of that this morning. Whatever God may lay on your heart, these people are here just to pray with you and encourage you. Take advantage of it. Come while we sing. Let's stand.